the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Dr. Karen Von Hippel from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., speaks on the root causes of terrorism. Dr. Von Hippel graduated from East High School in Anchorage, and her parents continue to live in Anchorage where they are physicians. From East High School, Dr. Von Hippel went on to Yale, then Oxford University, then the London School of Economics, where she received a doctorate in international relations. Before moving to Washington, she was senior research fellow at the Center for Defense Studies at King's College London and spent several years working for the United Nations and the European Union in Somalia and Kosovo. She also directed a project on the European counter-terrorist reforms funded by the MacArthur Foundation and edited the volume Europe Confronts Terrorism, published in 2005. Karen Von Hippel is now living in Washington, D.C. and is aligned with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, also called the CSIS. Dr. Von Hippel is co-director of the CSIS Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project and senior fellow with the CSIS International Security Program. On Friday, December 12th, Vice President of the Anchorage School Board, Macon Roberts, presented Dr. Von Hippel with an award of excellence, thanking her for visiting with teachers and students at three Anchorage high schools, including Bartlett, South, and East High School. After accepting the award, Dr. Von Hippel spoke on the root causes of terrorism at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents Dr. Karen Von Hippel.
Thank you. Thank you to the World Affairs Council and to all of you for welcoming me here today. I do give a lot of public talks and now all over the place. And I have to say, this is, for me, the most intimidating audience because I have far too many friends and family members here, especially people who knew me when I was sort of, let's just say, a little bit obnoxious maybe and younger. So, but thank you for welcoming me here today. I wanted to talk a little bit about the root causes of terrorism. It's kind of a controversial subject to talk about. I started working on this area. Actually, I became an expert on terrorism really on September 12th, 2001. Like other people, I got dragged into it because of my own experience in places like Somalia and Kosovo. And I was asked by some of the donors, like the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the Danes, UN, and others, to help come up with ways that development assistance can work to fight the root causes of terrorism. So I started looking at it back then, and that's what I really want to talk about is some of the work I've done in this area. I think, and I'll try to speak for about 25 minutes, so we have time for discussion, so hopefully it won't go on for too long, but I think most people here, when we think about having an effective counter-terrorist or counterinsurgency campaign, we like to think about a comprehensive, holistic approach. So on the one side, you deal with the symptoms, and that's really where you bring the police, the military, intelligence, legal, financial, and other actors in to try to interdict terrorists, to capture them before they commit crimes, hopefully, and often to investigate afterwards. And that's really where the bulk of our energy has gone since September 11th. That's really where most of the activity has been focused on this. Of course, we also need to focus on the causes. And really on this area, unfortunately, we haven't dedicated as much energy to this as we probably should have. Although today that has started to change. Now you will hear very senior members of the U.S. government and the military saying that terrorists can't be defeated by military means alone, that we need to fight root causes, and we need to fight root causes in the same places where terrorists live, breed, and train. And this is really because terrorist groups have really been able to expand their reach and their influence because they build and expand their constituencies. And it's a term that Professor Louise Richardson at Harvard calls the enabling environment. Another term is called complicit society. And what this means are these are potential sympathizers who are not only in the Arab and Muslim world, but they also live in Europe and North America. Now, many of these people may not themselves use violence, but they either sympathize with the arguments and the platforms of the terrorists, or they're intimidated into silence. Over the last seven plus years since 9/11, we've seen the Al-Qaeda group really expand this constituency of sympathizers. I think most of us have read about polls in the Arab and Muslim world that show a lot of anti-American sentiment. It's increased over the last 7 years. Some of these same polls also show that Al-Qaeda is viewed as a legitimate resistance movement by a lot of people in places where, we hope that they don't view, Al-Qaeda like that. And this is because they've been much better than we have at targeting the enabling environment. They're much better than we are so far in the battle of ideas. Just to give you one example from Afghanistan, where I was about a month ago, before a suicide bomber sets off their belt in a market somewhere, there'll be two cameramen also in the market filming this right before it happens. They immediately burn it onto a DVD and they put it on the web. And so they're much quicker than we are, and we only recently just started to have our own strategic communications capacity to try to fight back in this way. So really, for us to succeed against this terrorist movement, what we need to do is we need to win over this wider community so that they also oppose terrorists in their communities, in their cities, in their states, and even in the virtual world where many of the battles are taking place. I think you can think of it, in a sense, you can think of it as concentric circles. So in the middle circle, you have the hardcore terrorists. And I guess for me, I'm less worried about that individual terrorist because it's always going to be very difficult to try to stop everybody committing a crime. But around them, in the next concentric circle, you have the enabling environment. And that's the community that we need to win over so that they oppose them. Once they try to oppose them in the communities, then you can go to standard policing and other surveillance techniques that will work much better. I think, people who are familiar with the success in Italy against the mafia, you see this happening, that they get the communities to go against them. In places like Northern Ireland, in Yemen, in Greece, even in Iraq, this strategy has proved to work. And so that's really what we need to do. And today I want to talk about three areas that impact this enabling environment, the second tier, not really the inner core, and where I think if we made some reforms, we could really make a difference in this counter-terrorist campaign. And the three are cultures of impunity and corruption, basic social services, and then the third is education. These aren't the only root causes, and if people are just interested, we can talk about it a bit more in the discussion, but I'm trying not to go on for too long today so we have time to talk. So the first is corruption and cultures of impunity. And so far, we found that the Al-Qaeda network, the network movement and organization, it's all three now. It's not just an organization, but it's a network and a movement, as well as some nationally focused Islamist groups such as Hezbollah and Hamas. They've been able to find a more receptive environment when the local government is perceived as being corrupt. I think we all remember that bin Laden was always decrying the very corrupt Saudi state. He is viewed by many Muslims as virtuous. He sacrifices money for the cause of ordinary Muslims. I think we all remember the Taliban when it took over between 1996 and 2001. They took over in Afghanistan with relative ease because the Afghanistan state had been run by various warlords who were really, treating people horribly. They were raping and pillaging. Mullah Omar, who started the Taliban movement, the story about it, and I don't know if it's true or if it's an urban myth, but the story is that he went to rescue two girls that had been kidnapped and were being raped by these warlords. And so he started this movement, and other people joined him to try to defeat these terrorists. Now, I know there's some people like Caroline in the room who spend a lot of time in Afghanistan, so she can also help out and tell us a bit more about this later. There have been focus groups in places like Morocco that have found that the Justice and Development Party, which is the largest opposition party and the Islamist political party in Morocco, the popularity of this party was based on the perception that it is non-corrupt, and all other parties in Morocco were viewed by the population as lying to the voters during elections. Of course, in Lebanon, I think most of us know that Hezbollah's increasing popularity, especially amongst the Shia residents, is attributed to the view, as another focus group said, that Hezbollah is the only party that provides security and services while remaining transparent. In Somalia, a country I spent some time in, mid-2006, an Islamist political grouping took over, and a large percentage of the population supported this group for the same reasons as in Afghanistan. There were many, many warlords that had been really brutalizing the population, and this group was seen as being non-corrupt and transparent. Cultures of impunity, of course, are not only more sympathetic to this movement, this larger al-Qaeda movement, but also it makes it easier for these cultures to be penetrated by terrorists because of the ease which people can bribe government officials for terrorists to find sanctuary, establish bases, and other illicit activities. So it's sort of at the first level, one area to think about in terms of winning back this enabling environment is to really support good governance, rule of law, you know, really at basic levels in a number of societies. So that's sort of the first area. The second area, and it's related to this, is in a number of cases, terrorist groups have been able to broaden their appeal through the provision of basic services to the poor. Now, it's not clear if the provision of services makes more people want to become terrorists, but it certainly makes them more popular in their community. I think we all know that charity has been central to the growth of the Muslim Brotherhood movement. It's also the same for groups like Hezbollah and Hamas again. These charities are often quicker off the mark in emergencies. In Pakistan, after the earthquake in 2005, the group that got there first to deliver aid was actually the same group that's been in the papers this last week, affiliated to Lashkar-e-Taiba, the ones that caused the attacks in Mumbai. They were the first to provide relief in Pakistan after the earthquake. After the Israel war with Lebanon in July and August 2006, actually it's quite interesting, depending on who you talk to in Lebanon, they'll describe it as Israel's war with Lebanon or Israel's war with Hezbollah. But after that war, I think many of us remember in the newspapers, we saw Hezbollah-sponsored charities bulldozing parts of town, helping to rebuild homes, distributing cash. They were much quicker off the mark than the Lebanese government was, and certainly than the UN and other international agencies were. I was in Lebanon about 9 months after the war ended, and I spoke to a woman who spends a lot of time with Hezbollah, and she was telling me about just 10 days after the war ended, they had sent out 100 volunteers to the southern suburbs where these large houses had been destroyed and building blocks had been destroyed, and they all came back to a meeting where they put this needs assessment, all the damage that had been done, on the wall, and it was on this incredible computer graphic, and she said it was the best needs assessment she had ever seen. It was the most elaborate and the most detailed one that she had ever seen, and they had managed to accomplish this in a much shorter time span than many of the UN agencies would have been able to do. I think we could also say the same thing about Hamas. Another one of my colleagues in Washington, his name is Haim Malka, he has been looking a lot at Hamas and how charity plays a central role in the growth of that movement. A research organization called the International Crisis Group, which does really great international reporting on conflicts, they interviewed the heads of Hamas, and the heads of Hamas themselves will say one of the reasons we're so popular is because of charity and because of the expanding welfare services we provide in the community. In other parts of the world, the results are similar. Another one of my colleagues, Sarah Mendelson, she and Ted Gerber did some surveys in the North Caucasus region, and they concluded whoever gets there first and delivers the social goods, the Russian government, the West, or the Islamist parties, will shape the political trajectory of this region. In Somalia, as I mentioned, a place that I've been working on a lot, you know, the state collapsed in January 1991, and since that time, a number of these Islamist charities have been building schools, hospitals, mosques over the last two decades. And while the international community, we've been there, we just haven't really been able to accomplish that much. We spent very little money, and we haven't been as successful in building up social support networks. And so these groups are far more popular. They're delivering something to the population. It's fairly obvious. Now, some people argue that extreme religious groups of all types, not just Islamic ones, but of all types, provide charity in order to expand their base and to gain more recruits. A variation on this argument is that that many radical groups purposely link assistance with politics because the two are really an inextricable part of their worldview, identity, and purpose. And I think for those of you who go to church, you know that help for the poor is really core to all religions. But whatever the motive, it's certainly clear that these charities do fulfill a number of critical functions in places where the state does not provide those services. And so an end result is that they often succeed in realigning community loyalty in these places. The monopoly that they have on aid also will make it far more difficult for someone who may not agree with the political philosophy of the group to speak out against that group, because they may be afraid or they may be not interested in helping the government locate suspects. The government isn't delivering to them, but these groups are, so of course they're going to be more loyal. But really, I think at the most basic level, it's really often the lack of government-provided services or international donor support, meaning all of us who do this work in many places, that make many people vulnerable to and susceptible to this ideology. The sad fact is that these extremist charities get very little competition from the rest of us in many parts of the world. And so it may be that the ideological viewpoint that's espoused by these charities is not the most important thing, but most parents want to send their kids to school, and so if they have no other options, they'll go with what options are on offer. Now, given that many developing states don't have the capacity to provide services in the near term, and they may not in the long term, I think we need to get far more creative and flexible in the way that we provide services in many parts of the world, especially in difficult places, so that we can help to reduce the appeal of many of these organizations. Now, of course, we also have, I believe, a humanitarian imperative to help out as well. But this is another reason to really think about improving the way that we do this work. What I found quite interesting in Afghanistan is that while the Taliban has expanded its reach, it's far more sophisticated, it's far more brutal than the Taliban 2001, and there's now a Taliban in Pakistan as well. There's an Afghan Taliban and a Pakistan Taliban. They haven't yet adopted this strategy. So what they do is they provide some sort of rough justice. They provide a lot of fear. While we may be working in some of these villages by day, we're not always sleeping in these towns, and at night they come in with what they call night letters. They threaten the families. They sometimes throw acid on little girls who are going to school. And so they provide a lot of fear and rough justice, but they don't yet provide security. And I do believe that that's a window that maybe we're not taking advantage of as much as we should in Afghanistan. So there is, I think, an opening there. So now just to go to the third one, education, which just to sort of drill down on one social service. I think education is quite important. There's been a very big debate on the role of education since September 11th, and especially the role of some of these extremist charities. They're called madrasas. I think most people have heard that term, madrasa, in the singular, madari in the plural. Some people think that children who go to these schools are cannon fodder for terrorist organizations. One New York Times writer wrote about Jihadi U as in university, and other people argue that actually these kids don't even have the basic skills to carry out a terrorist attack. Now, I actually think both sides of this argument are right some of the time. Now, we all know that the 19 hijackers who committed the September 11th attacks were neither poor nor uneducated. Obviously, bin Laden comes from an extremely wealthy family, very educated. The Muslim Brotherhood movement mostly emerged from secular universities in Cairo, and Lebanese and Palestinian members of Hezbollah and Hamas also tend to come from the middle classes. But at the same time, it's also true that in other terrorist hotspots, and if you particularly look at Pakistan and Afghanistan, which today is really our biggest threat, then you do have some of these extremist madrasas that are providing recruits for terrorist and militant organizations. Now, most of these schools are heavily subsidized and free of charge, so kids can sleep there, they get free food, free books, free clothes, and so they do provide an attractive option for a poor family. In Pakistan alone, over 1.5 million children attend these schools. Now, not all madrasas have an extremist agenda. Many teach secular subjects, and many also teach middle class children, just like in religious schools in America. So many of them are no different than religious schools in any part of the world. But for children who attend the more radical madrasas, these kids are taught a very violent worldview and to despise Western influences from a very early age. One researcher, Ali Riaz, said that these children are taught that Muslims all around the world are under siege from sinister forces, which they must fight to their death. Another researcher, Craig Davis, was looking at education in amongst Afghan children, and he came across this one example from a fourth grade math book. Now, I think a few of you who are good at math, I know Kurt and Nick and my brother Roe is good at math, so you guys can solve this math puzzle. So this is from a fourth grade math puzzle. The speed of a Kalashnikov bullet is 800 meters per second. If a Russian is at a distance of 3,200 meters from the Mujahideen, and that Mujahideen aims at the Russian's head, calculate how many seconds it will take the bullet to strike the Russian in the forehead. All right, you guys got it, right? Now, these violent examples were supposedly edited out of these textbooks in the early 90s, but this researcher found that many of these books were still in use even in 1999 and 2000. And he concluded that in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and he concluded that a major theme of these textbooks for grades 1 through 6 was the promotion of violence for the sake of Islam. Many of these kids, too, who have attended the radical madrasas have been used as cannon fodder. Mullah Omar famously called on the Pakistani-based madrasas in the late 1990s to help when the Taliban was steamrolling across Afghanistan. And in response, one of the leaders of a very famous madrasa called the Haqqaniya Madrasa in Northwest Frontier Province in Pakistan, he shut the doors and sent all 2,800 students to the front line to fight. The word Talib itself means religious student, and there's an estimated maybe one-third of the Taliban went to these schools. Now, since 9/11, so that was during the sort of this anti-Soviet period and taking over of Afghanistan by the Taliban. But since 9/11, many of these same schools have also been sending students and their graduates to kill NATO troops in Afghanistan, as well as to kill civilians in Pakistan and other parts of the world. These schools also provide sort of what you call short-term executive education for adults who want to potentially join the jihad from Europe and other places. Supposedly, the 7/7 bombers in London had attended one of these madrasas, had done one of these short-term courses. I visited, when I was in Pakistan in April, I visited a madrasa, and just one of them in Northwest Frontier Province. And I did, when I went upstairs to see the boys all praying, the room was probably this big, and it was all boys who were spending about 5 hours memorizing the Quran, and I saw some older students there. Now, who knows what kind of madrasa it was. I couldn't tell just from a visit, but it was interesting to see the range in age. Now, it's mostly in the Indian subcontinent, meaning India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, as well as parts of Afghanistan, where these schools are used to promote a political agenda, unlike in the Arab world, where they don't play such a role. Increasingly, other parts of the world, like Indonesia and East and West Africa, are starting to resemble this South Asia model. It's important to point out that very few students who attend these schools will become terrorists. Very few, even if there are some exceptions, as in parts of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And many of those who do become terrorists won't be as skilled as their educated counterparts, and that may account for some of the failed suicide and bombing attacks that we've had in places like Afghanistan. It's also the case that many public schools in these same countries teach the kids only a marginally less violent worldview. So just to conclude on the education part, yes, a number of poor madrasa kids will become terrorists, but for those that don't and who graduate from these same schools, they're unlikely to gain any skills that will help them to work in modern society. And so, therefore, I argue that they will also populate this enabling environment. And that's why I think it's really important to ensure that educational reform is a priority for most of our counter-radicalization programs that we have in many parts of the world. So I'm now about to conclude. The research on root causes is definitely not conclusive. I think this is partially because we haven't really been focused on it as much as we could, but it's also because the terrorist threat itself evolves at a very rapid pace, and we don't always keep up. There is no prototype terrorist. You can find exceptions for every rule. But at the same time, I think there are areas where if we make much more targeted reforms, we can make a difference. And that would be, of course, in supporting anti-corruption and good governance, helping to provide basic social services, and then just helping to improve really basic education. It can be religious or non-religious education. It just needs to be a more well-rounded education. I think if we could target the enabling environment, in more appropriate ways, this type of counter-radicalization strategy would really help to weaken and isolate these terrorists in their communities and make them much more vulnerable to policing and standard surveillance. I think probably these basic issues are just as important to people in this room as they are to people in many parts of the world. The British academic Fred Halliday, who is somebody I used to work with in London, he's described the ideology of Al-Qaeda as one that thrives on its intoxicating incoherence. Now, I think if we can implement effective reforms, maybe we can help to ensure that it is no longer intoxicating, but it remains incoherent. So thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Karen von Hippel from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, recorded Friday, December 12th in Anchorage. Dr. von Hippel is co-director of the CSIS Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project and senior fellow with the CSIS International Security Program. Following her talk on the root causes of terrorism, she responded to questions from the audience. First, she was asked to comment on the distinct U.S. policy issues underlying terrorist movements in different parts of the world.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. There's a difference, obviously, between some of the nationally focused groups and those with more of an international agenda. I sometimes wonder what would have happened if we hadn't gone to war in Iraq. And after September 11th, when we had a lot of support behind us from all over the world, if we really had focused much more on Afghanistan, which was where these guys had come from, we might be in a very different position than we are today. But because we didn't, because we did have this global war on terror and this rhetoric which has been so damaging, we actually have exacerbated the situation, and that's contributed really to so many people in so many parts of the world not only not liking America, but not liking American foreign policy, not trusting us with our aid. I had there was a study that was done in Jordan, just to give you an example, about they looked at five or six Arab and Muslim states, and they found that majorities in five Arab states agreed with the statement that read, "The U.S. aims to dominate other countries by offering foreign aid." So people don't even believe our commitment is sincere when we do work in these places. There is a difference, certainly, between national terrorist movements. The problem is that now many of them are overlapping and learning from one another. So even if they have a very different agenda, Hamas may have a different agenda, they're learning from what's happening in Afghanistan, from Iraq, they learn very, very quickly. We now have suicide bombers in Somalia. We never would have had that, even 3 or 4 years ago. In Afghanistan, IEDs are a huge threat, and they've learned that from Iraq. So, there is a difference between many, many different groups, and many of them have a local agenda, but they themselves often describe themselves as part of this larger movement.
Are you familiar with the bestseller Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Change the World, One School at a Time, by Greg Mortensen? An audience member asked. Have you ever visited any of his schools? And do you have any comments on what he's accomplished as far as education reform?
Yeah, no, I haven't. I just ordered his book, so I'm looking forward to reading it. I mean, I don't mean to say that all of our development work has been a failure. And there's certainly, I guess you can always look at this like a bell curve. You'll have some very, very good examples on one end, and he's probably one on that end. And then the vast majority in the middle is okay. And then there's probably some underperforming on the other end. So there are some great efforts to reform schools. The Pakistani government is supposed to be taking the lead on reforming the madrasas, and they haven't done a very good job so far. And I think we put pressure on them to do this and to reform it, but we probably haven't also been dedicating as much money and effort to this as we should have. In my office, we started about 4 or 5 years ago looking at Pakistan, and really we were concerned that it was a very important country. It was a nuclear-armed country, and if things went south in Pakistan, maybe the government wouldn't be prepared for it. And we started asking people, what are your plans for Pakistan if things go wrong? We asked people in the U.S. government, and they said, we don't want to think about it because it's too scary. So we thought, aha, that's not a very good, it's not a very good response. So then we started saying, well, how much money are we spending in Pakistan, and how joined up is our aid? And we just used a couple interns, and we went through public source documents. So it was only public money. And we came up with this figure that you see a lot of $10 billion since 9/11. After we published this figure, the Congressional Research Office then did another study to verify our results, and they came up with a little bit of a higher figure. But, and of course, we found that of that $10 billion, you know, the vast majority went to buy weapons, and the weapons were being used more for a potential fight against India rather than even for counter-terrorist activities. Now, today, the Pakistani government is far more aware that they have a huge problem, that they need to coordinate with Afghanistan, that probably we need to figure out ways of bringing India in on board, and, of course, that development is a huge priority. But so far, most of the money hasn't been dedicated to that. So Senator Biden just came up with the Biden-Lugar legislation of $7.2 billion for Pakistan. Most of that money is supposed to be dedicated for non-military means. But at the moment, we're way behind where we should be on that end.
Can you please discuss how education reform has been financed in foreign countries like the Middle East?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And in some ways, you could say, well, there's zakat, right? So one of the five pillars of Islam is you have to give 2.5% of your salary to charity. Typically, families will give it to somebody they know or the orphanage or whatever. So some of that money probably comes from zakat. Some of it comes from the community, just sort of helping to support the local school. Some of it comes from very wealthy Saudi funders and other Gulf funders who have an extreme view. And so some of the people who've been looking at madrasa reform, and they said, well, maybe what we need to do is we don't need to close the school down. We just need to have them teach secular subjects. And that's probably the best way because you already have a community school that's supported. And that does work in some instances. But some other places where they've tried to do this, they find that their backers in Saudi and other places don't want them to change the curricula. And so they have to that's when you think about, well, maybe we build another school. But, you know, it's complicated building other schools, and maybe you just need teacher salaries. I mean, there's lots of educational reform is incredibly complicated. But I think I'd be more focused on paying teachers. I don't care really where the kids sit. You know, they can be in homes and building a lot of schools, because you end up spending a lot more money building schools than really teacher salaries, which are the most important, training teachers, making sure you have good textbooks, things like that.
Noting that Dr. Von Hippel spent some time in Somalia, an audience member wanted to know what she attributes to Somalia's failure to establish a central government for the past 17 years.
That's a good question. For those of us who are kind of masochistic enough to continue to work on Somalia, we talk about this a lot. This is sort of an issue we talk about a lot. And one of a colleague of mine who works at Davidson University, he was talking to some economists and about Somalia, because we've tried everything in Somalia, really, and nothing has seemed to work. And one of these economists said, well, that's what we call a wicked problem. It's a problem that doesn't actually have a solution. So you could sort of say, well, maybe at one extreme, maybe some places just, you know, aren't going to look the way that we think that they should look. I think that there's still a little bit of hope, but I think that we've done a lot of things. We, the U.S. government, have done a lot of things to make it worse in Somalia. So over the past, 4 or 5 years even, while we were learning a lot in Iraq and getting much better at our response in Iraq and sort of getting things to trying to turn Iraq around, we weren't using any of those same lessons from Iraq in places like Somalia. In Somalia, all we've done is really try to target individual terrorists. We've had a lot of these predator drone strikes, you know, these unmanned aerial planes that tried to kill a few people that we're looking for who are supposedly in Somalia. We don't even know they're there, and spending very little money and very little effort on trying to bring all the people to the table to really talk about setting up a new government. So the situation has actually deteriorated. When I started working on Somalia probably about 95, and I would say by 2004 and 2005, before this Islamic group took over, Somalia was probably the fastest growing economy in East Africa. But no one was really that interested in Somalia either. So it was Somalis from all over the world who were sending money back home, who were investing in businesses, and just kind of getting on with it. And then, you know, we were worried about these terrorists that were supposedly hiding out in Somalia, and we started doing a lot of things that, you know, that caused blowback, basically. The U.S. government did. So it isn't an easy, there isn't really an easy answer to it. But I think we can make a stronger effort politically to get people to the table and to talk about really establishing a government. But
what would you change about how the United States distributes foreign aid? Another audience member asked.
Yeah, I think, it's interesting to watch the Bush administration, which has been, you know, the most anti-nation building, embrace nation building in the most extraordinary ways. And the way they embraced it, they sent in huge contractors. We're going in there with tons and tons of money, doing all these things that I don't think we should be doing in these countries. I think we should really be trying to use local capacity in much smarter ways. You often hear when people go to Afghanistan, they say, well, there's no local capacity to do it. Well, there probably is, but we're probably not very good at identifying it and working with it. So, yeah, I think we need to be much smarter with the way we do work. I don't think it's how much money we spend. We spend $5 million in Somalia and billions in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're still not doing a very good job at this work. So I think it's just getting smarter with our aid. It's getting probably doing it in more quiet ways. It's working with locals. It's working with diaspora communities. Probably learning a lot more about these places than we do before we go in.
Can you please discuss the role of the military? Can it be used effectively?
Right. No, it's a good question. And, it's far sexier to be going in and killing the bad guys than to be building schools and, train stations and things. I actually think the military have probably been on the best learning curve out of all of our organizations. So I think if you watch what the military does in many of these places, I think they get it and they've learned quicker than almost anybody else. And part of the reason is because they've had to, because they're at the front of all this. I mean, they're doing most of the aid work in Afghanistan now because it's too dangerous for most civilians to go out there. So the military have really had an incredible learning curve on this. And I've seen this because I remember I worked with these guys in Kosovo and even in 2000, and they didn't want to get involved in any of the local, they didn't want to escort kids. They didn't want to do anything like that. They drove around in these big tanks looking like RoboCop. Now, if you look at the U.S. military, they're on the ground. They're walking around. They're getting to know communities. So they've actually done a very good job. The concern is, we're not what to do in Afghanistan. Well, I don't think we're losing in Afghanistan. I think it's probably more of a stalemate situation. So there's a lot of talk, should we send more troops out? If you send more troops out, we're probably going to have more violence because you'll have more people fighting. And that may be a short-term response, but long-term, hopefully that, might provide the space or clear out the space so that the development agencies and other people can come in and do the development work. I mean, ideally, you don't want military doing development work. You want the people who are experts in this to do it. But in some places, it's just too dangerous. And we're now at a situation where we're very challenged because we're now trying to rebuild states and build peace at the same time that people are trying to kill us. And we've never really done that before. Normally, we don't try to rebuild societies when there's a lot of fighting. We just get involved in the fighting. Now we're trying to do both at the same time and trying to figure out how to do that. So it's an incredible challenge.
It seems like when the United States enters another country, we're extremely dependent on translators, an audience member noted. Is there any discussion within the United States to develop language and our abilities to communicate better with foreign communities?
Yeah, no. I mean, that's definitely an emphasis now. And I think if you look on the CIA recruiting webpages or the State Department, they're looking for people with those language skills. I guess I'm a little bit, I'd be pushing to use Americans more because we have Americans from all over the world. We have a lot of Americans who speak Arabic, a lot of Americans who speak Pashto. We've been kind of nervous about giving them security clearance. But, I think they're going to be far more valuable to us than, someone from Indiana or Anchorage who's never traveled anywhere before and who's just learning the language for the first time. And I don't think we're being smart enough about the people we already have in the United States. But, yeah, languages are incredibly important.
Next, an audience member asked Dr. Von Hippel her thoughts on the incoming Obama administration. What do you think about the people President-elect Obama has selected so far and the policy they will develop, he asked.
That's all we do in Washington. We sit around and gossip about transition all the time, so we're all obsessed with it. I've been involved. I did in a bipartisan way. My think tank's bipartisan, but in my spare time, I did a little bit of work on some of these teams for Obama. And I guess one of the things you can say is that, yeah, hopefully he's being very smart about who he's choosing. So far, I'm impressed with some of the picks that he's made. I don't think we can expect things to get better overnight because I think it's really filtered across our system, the way that we've been working and the way we've been, the way we treat other people. It's really filtered across our system. I mean, it's interesting. One of my colleagues spends a lot of time in America going around and talking to groups like this, and he asks Americans, how do people view us abroad? And most Americans say we're perceived as arrogant. You know, and I bet you most people in this room would probably say that. And, you know, when you, you know, we are the biggest power, we are the strongest and the richest. And I think we need to sort of relearn a bit of humility. We need to learn how to listen better than we have. And I think many people get that. And there are very, you know, a lot of bright people from any political party who do understand that. And you meet some really outstanding people when you go to these places who are living in very difficult situations and really trying to make a difference. So I guess, you know, I'm hopeful that things will get better. I'm hopeful that Obama, because he has such a different message, and he's seen differently, and he's seen to be someone who listens, who doesn't just decide on his, you know, whatever instincts that he has. He listens to a lot of people. He listens to a lot of different perspectives before he makes up his mind. I'm hoping things will get better. He certainly has a window of opportunity now. So let's hope he uses it wisely in the next 6 months for the next year. But then, you know, these challenges are extraordinary in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. And he's got some great people. I mean, I think the Secretary of Defense is excellent. I think that some of these reviews that are underway of what should we do in Afghanistan, hopefully will come up some better recommendations. So, you know, a lot of the problems in these countries have been there for a long time. The Clinton administration wasn't necessarily any better at responding to it. It's not a political thing, but it's just generally we need to get much smarter at the way we do this type of work.
Last, an audience member asked Dr. Von Hippel to describe how zakat, one of the five pillars of Islam, meaning the practice of charitable giving, compares to our idea of charity and assistance in the United States.
The way that it's described anyway in the Quran is that it's charity is one of the five pillars of Islam, but it's charity that's given in a way that doesn't humiliate the recipient. And I think that we're not always so good at that when we give out our aid. We have our flags and our stamps all over everything. And I think people are more grateful and more likely to use aid if it's given in a more subtle way. You know, USAID, the branding officers that go around the world to make sure that our flags and our stamps are the right size. Now, there's nothing wrong with people knowing where the aid came from, so it doesn't have to be secret. But I think we can maybe get a little bit smarter in the way that we do that. Now, there are some great U.S. government programs that do that. I mean, in the Fatah region, in the tribal area of Pakistan, there's a really outstanding program that has absolutely no American footprint on it at all. So we use different interlocutors who sit down in a shura with the local community, and they sit there for 2 weeks and decide, do we want a road? Do we want a school? We don't even care what they decide. For us, the process is the product. And so there are some great, great examples, but I don't think, you know, that's mainstreamed across the way. I mean, I think my point, I guess, from the beginning is to think about this in a more comprehensive way. So you do need to be focusing on interdicting and killing some of these really nasty guys. We do need our men in uniform, men and women in uniform, who are doing a great job, and to go out there and continue the work that we're doing. But on the other side, we need to be thinking about, you know, longer-term hearts and minds. There's a very good program in Singapore, actually, that's quite interesting. It's one of these counter-radicalization programs. And what they do is when they have, when they've captured one of these guys and he's in prison, they bring in imams and they argue on the Quran point by point with these guys. So they go back and forth and they have a dialogue. They also take care of the family of the person who's in prison to make sure that the family's okay. And they even have projects for the community. And so they're really trying to do it in a more holistic way. And this has been one of the more successful programs. And when they release these guys, so far anyway, you know, the jury's still out. It's too early. But so far it seems to be a more successful way of dealing with this. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents with Dr. Karen Von Hippel from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Dr. Von Hippel responded to questions from the audience following her talk entitled The Root Causes of Terrorism, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on Friday, December 12, 2008. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.